that seem to give that answer, one half. But I don't know. You know, you could say, well, that was just a coincidence. So the question is, can we make a more general sort of argument? Okay, and let me try to do this at a slightly more in a slightly more general fashion. So let's imagine that there exists some sort of generic summation machine, and the question is, what would you like the properties of this summation machine to have? Okay, so the first thing that we argue, or the first thing that we should remember, okay, from the discussion last time, is that arithmetic, at least at an infinite level, okay, is certainly not commutative. Okay, we do not expect a sum to obey the commutative rules of arithmetic infinitely. That is, arithmetic is not infinitely commutative, and arithmetic is not infinite. We don't expect arithmetic to be infinitely associative. If we give up everything, then we have a problem. But distributivity is a much more general sort of property, because that is the statement of linearity. And I would like arithmetic to be distributive. Okay, so I would like to have that in our general summation machine. But what I would say is this: maybe we want to give that up as well. Okay, and there are some summation machines, and important ones, that people use all the time in physics, which also give up distributivity. But for now, let's see if we can build a summation machine that respects distributivity. Okay, and that's because I like the idea that arithmetic, that the machine that we're going to build is linear. And I especially like that idea because both Euler and Borel are linear. Okay, so what properties should our summation machine have? So I don't know, maybe it's presumptuous or something like that. Maybe it's too fancy, but I'll use a fancy word. Let's say axiom one. So this is the axiom of distributivity or linearity. Okay. So what I'm saying is this: we will say that we have a summation machine. We don't know exactly what this summation machine is yet. We haven't specified how it works, in the sense that we specified exactly how Euler works and how to use it and how Borel works and how to use it. So we're going to leave that unspecified. So we're just saying we imagine that there is some sort of summation machine, which we're going to call S, and it turns a series, or it may have the ability to turn some series of this form into, it may associate a number that we're going to call the sum of the series, little s. Okay. So what I mean by axiom one is this: if we have the sum of a series of the form, let's say alpha times a sub n plus beta times b sub n, okay, and we apply this summation machine to it, I would like, just for the sake of linearity or distributivity, I would like this to have the form alpha times the sum of the series a sub n plus beta times the sum of the series b sub n. Okay? So that's what I mean by linearity. Okay. Assuming that this and this and this exist, we have to make that assumption. Okay. Now, the second axiom um, I mean, this is obviously just a property. This is incomplete. This doesn't specify anything yet. The second axiom is the axiom that says that if you apply our summation machine to a series that converges, it better get the same answer as you would get from adding up the series. Okay? Otherwise, we don't have any right to call this summation. So it better reduce to the right answer for the special cases where the series is convergent. And the way I'm going to impose that is as follows. I'm going to say, if you apply our summation machine to a series of the form sum from 0 to infinity a sub n, that this is the same as a0 plus the summation machine applied to the series from 1 to infinity of a sub n. That is, this is some unspecified machine. Okay? And it looks at a series, and it certainly, this is treated as a sum in the sense that I can pull off the first term on the sum and then apply the machine to the remaining terms, which may or may not be a convergent series. If it is a convergent series, of course, then you can just repeatedly apply this axiom and sum the series and show that the remainder goes to 0, blah, blah, blah. Okay? So these seem to be, now we may want to impose more axioms. We may be free to do that. We may not be. And in fact, I don't really know. I mean, this is a very interesting field to investigate. But I would like to say that these seem to me to be reasonable and fairly essential axioms for any summation machine. Okay? The interesting thing is that I haven't specified what the summation machine is, but it's clear that Euler and Borel satisfy these properties. Okay? You have a question?
Yeah, so what you wrote under axiom 1, mm-hmm. didn't you use commutivity? Because you had...
Didn't I use... Not at all. Well, oh, no, no, I haven't commuted.
If you have the first sum that you wrote looks to me like a1 plus b1 plus a2 plus b2 plus...
Right, exactly.
And then you pull the a's and b's apart. And you
now you're... In the sense of linearity, but I have not arranged any terms and I haven't associated any terms. I haven't done that. So I have a series, just as you say, I have a series of the form alpha a0 plus beta b0. That's the first term in the series, okay? The next term in the series is alpha a1 plus beta b1, and so on, okay? Now, commutivity would mean that I'm interchanging terms in the series. And I have no problem, by the way, just not at all, I have no problem with doing this, but because that's finite commutivity. And that would be consistent with axiom number 2. We can pull out the first term and pull out the second term and leave the remaining series, and then we can do anything we want finitely with the first term and the second term. I have no problem with that. The problem would be if we started making arrangements all the way out to infinity.
But isn't that just what you did? Because now you write it as all the A's added up plus all the B's added up.
Right.
So you separate it
out. That's what I mean by the distributivity or linearity. Okay. I have not changed the order of any of the terms in the series, and I have not associated any of the terms in the series. I have factored out a common factor from every term in the series. That's all. It's linear in that sense. But I didn't attempt to write the nth term before the mth term, you know, changing orders of terms or associating orders. I didn't do that. This is what is meant by infinite distributivity. Okay. Infinite linearity. I factored out an alpha from every term in the series. That I haven't associated any terms in the series. Okay, I wouldn't do that. Okay. So I'm leaving all of the terms in the series here.
But you're separating out A's and B's.
Sure, I'm separating the A's and B's.
So you're pulling out
I'm pulling
the A's
apart.
And the B's.
I'm pulling apart the A's and I'm pulling apart the B's. That's right. In the sense of linearity.
So then I could pull out I could call all the A's 1, and I could call all the B's 1.
But you have to order them, but you have to write them in that order. Do this, of course, if it doesn't exist. I mean, for this series, for example, if we applied it to this series, we just looked at axiom 1, we could write it as, rather than I put the words in your mouth, what do you think?
Then you can write it as an infinite sum of 1's plus an infinite sum of
1's. No, you reordered the terms. You have to be very careful.
But that's just what you did.
You could write it as an infinite sum of 1 plus 0 plus 1 plus 0 plus 1 plus 0. You could do that and add that to the series. 0 minus 1, 0 minus 1. You could do that. But you can't take away the 0. You associated all those terms. You combined this 0 and this 1 and this 0 and this 1, and you said I have an infinite series of 1s. But you have no right to do that. You associated, you see? So you are allowed, of course, by this, to write this series in the form 1 plus 0 plus 1 plus 0 plus 1 plus 0, if you like, and then add that to the series 0 minus 1, 0 minus 1. You can do that, but you can't throw away the zeros, because then you'd be associating terms. Okay, don't think for a moment, or let me give you an example, okay, just to make sure that you understand what I'm saying. Don't think for a moment that you have the right to throw away zeros in a series. I mean, for example, just as an example, let's go back to this series. Okay, I mean, you're asking a really good question, but let's go deeply into it. You could say this series, you could rewrite this series as the series, but let's work over here. You could write that series as the series 1 plus 0 minus 1 plus 1 plus 0 minus 1 plus 1 plus 0 minus 1, and so on.
Yeah.
Okay, that's what you did. You added some zeros or took away some zeros. You can't do that. Infinite. Of course, you could take away a finite number. Obviously, 6 plus 0 is 6. We wouldn't argue that. But if you do that an infinite number of times, you already saw in the case of Fourier series that could lead to ambiguities. Okay, you can't take away an infinite number of zeros. And to show you that that's true, let's add up this series. The question is, what do you think the sum of this series is? Okay, it certainly is not 1/2. I don't know what it is. Let's add it up and find out. Okay, so the question is, what does Mr. Euler, for example, say the sum of this series is? So Euler says what you have to do is multiply the nth term by x to the n. Okay, so that would say this is 1 plus 0 times x, which is 0, minus x squared plus x cubed plus 0 times x to the 4th minus x to the 5 plus x to the 6th, and so on. Okay? And he says, let's assume that x is smaller than 1. So the series is now a convergent series. Okay, so this is I think we called this f of x yesterday, or f of x. Okay? Now, this series is convergent, and it's a Taylor series. And therefore, Taylor series are robust, and it's perfectly acceptable to change the orders of the terms of the Taylor series. So I can write this as the sum of two series. One series of the form 1 plus x cubed plus x to the 6th plus and so on. Okay. And another series of the form minus x squared plus x to the 5 plus x to the 8 and so on. Okay. Now, this series here is a geometric series. Okay? And the sum of that series is 1 over 1 minus x cubed. And this series here is x squared times that series, okay, which is 1 over 1 minus x cubed. So if you combine this, there's a minus sign here, if you combine that, you get 1 minus x squared over 1 minus x cubed. Okay? And if we factor the numerator, you get 1 minus x and 1 plus x. Okay? And if you factor the denominator, what are the factors of the denominator? Say it again.
1 minus x.
Okay, and we can cancel this factor. So this function f of x, so we've concluded that f of x is equal to 1 plus x over 1 plus x squared. Okay, and now Mr. Euler says take the limit. So he says the Euler sum is the limit as x goes to 1 of f of x, which is 2/3. Okay? Which is not the same series. So you have to be very careful. Of course, if you took out the zeros, you would be associating terms. But so we have no right to do that.
So I understand that I can't just stick things in there. But what I say is you wrote sum from 0 to infinity, alpha times base of n plus beta times base of n.
Yes.
Now I say call alpha 1.
Call
beta minus 1, call beta n 1.
Wait, say it again. Call
alpha is 1.
Alpha is 1, yeah.
A sub n is 1.
Is 1, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Beta is minus 1.
Is minus 1. And beta and bn is minus 1. Great. So the series that you're summing
is
1. Okay. So the series you're summing here, this series now, okay, what's in your parenthesis is 0. The nth term in your parenthesis is 0. So the series that you're considering is 0 plus 0 plus 0 plus 0 plus 0. Okay? Which is 0. Okay? Now, what is in here is the series alpha, you say, is 1. And this is the series 1 plus 1 plus 1 plus 1. Which is, so the question is, you can ask, what is the series 1 plus 1 plus 1 plus 1? And that is infinity. And it's perfectly acceptable for the sum of a series to be infinity. I have no problem with that. Infinity is a number. Lots of series are divergent. Okay, there's no problem with that. So what you have done, so this series is 0 plus 0 plus 0, which is unambiguously.
So the point is that you have here.
Right, but remember what I said. Hang on. Remember what I said. I said that we can write this if each of these things exist. Remember? I said you can break it into this form if each of these things exist. Now, there's no guarantee in any given case whether or not our summation machine is powerful enough to make that sum exist. So the left-hand side exists. Each of the right-hand sides do not exist in the sense that they add up to infinity. No, I don't have any problem with that. It's just that in that particular case, it failed because this did not exist as a sum. By the way, there are lots of series. I don't have a problem with infinity. Okay, it's perfectly acceptable if we go through an analysis and we study a series like this. It is a perfectly acceptable conclusion to say that our summation machine tells us that this series is infinity. I don't have a problem with that. That's fine. There's nothing wrong with a series that adds up to infinity. It might not add up to infinity, but if our summation machine says this series is infinity, that's great. In fact, it's even useful. I'll show you why in a second, but let me answer.
You've been very upset. You've been.
I think what MITRE means is that on the left hand side of that equation, it looks like you're adding a1 to b1.
Exactly.
But isn't what you mean? You're adding the series of A to the series of B.
No, but that's not true.
I think I was confused about
that. No, wait. That's not true. That's not what I said. What I said is, this is an infinite series of terms. Okay? And I have a formula for the nth term in the series. The nth term in this series, C sub n, is what you get if you multiply alpha times some number k sub n plus beta times some number b sub n. It says exactly what is written here. That's what it says.
Okay, so you are assuming a new linear property of the sigma sign that is, you know, that is just a formula.
That's right.
Right?
This is a linear
because
property.
Because the way to write it will be alpha then sigma plus
right.
Beta then sigma, because then
that's
you have the linearity.
So what I'm saying is that this summation machine respects the linearity of that sigma sign.
Yeah, but we do not have that linearity of that sign because it is just a formal. Like it's just a
that's
formal
right.
sign.
That's
right.
Right. So I'm making it explicit. I'm saying,
you're saying
this
explicit.
Is some formal structure now.
And
it
that is equal to alpha then okay. sigma plus beta then
right.
the sign. Right?
It doesn't mean this is some formal sign, and what it doesn't mean is add up the terms in the series all the way up to infinity. It can't mean that, okay? Except in very special cases where it exists. In general, this will not exist, so you can't add it up. But we are saying that there is a linear structure in here, and we're going to have our summation machine respect that structure. Okay, that's all. And it may not. It may fail if this does not exist. And that's what you looked at before.
I think so. My confusion was that to me this looked just like a series above, but really this is a series above with an association. So here you have A
yes.
and B associated together,
yes.
which is something you can't get rid of when you actually write out the series. And
right.
that's what I was confused about.
Yeah,
but
these are associated. These are in brackets.
Exactly.
But we're not going to try to associate this with anything else, and we're not going to try to associate it with the term in front or the term behind. We're not going to try to do that. Okay. Of course, we could do it a finite number of times, but not an infinite number of times. So we can't do it all the way off to infinity. Yeah. Okay.
So when we look at the series of numbers, 1 minus 1 plus 1 minus 1 plus 1, what forbids of saying that instead of ours terms being 1 minus 1, 1 minus 1, what forbids that saying that 1 minus 1 is our term of the series?
You associated terms.
No, I'm just saying, if I look at the expression, 1 minus 1...
You associated terms.
No, I can't...
Yes, you did.
No, I didn't... No.
Look, stop. You wrote the series 1 minus 1 plus 1 minus 1 plus 1 minus 1. And you associated terms in subsequent terms of the series. You said you would like to consider this to be the first term of the series, and this to be the second term of the series.
Yes.
That's what it means to associate.
Okay, so far
you associated the first two terms and called it a new term. You associated the second two terms and called it a new term.
So I like that thing between the
brackets. Of course, you can do this and this. I have no problem with you doing that. Axiom number 2 says you can do that. However, you insisted on doing it an infinite number of times. You continued to do that all the way up to infinity. And arithmetic is not infinitely associated. Okay? You can do it for the first few terms, but you cannot do that. It's clear. You cannot do that forever. Okay, that's the problem with that argument, okay? Okay, don't... Okay, there are more questions. I don't know. Okay.
Right. Yeah, well, just to see in axiom 2, if I understand correctly, we should not be able to reload the first index 0 in the
sum. Of course. Oh, yes. We can call... This is just a dummy index. We're assuming that there are a countable number of
places. But I mean, if we...
If you would like to call this...
If, as you written there, you write the sum as 0, as 1 plus 0 plus...
Okay, we're going to do that. There's so many questions and we haven't gotten to the interesting part. That's exactly what we're going to do. You're jumping ahead, so let me not answer your question. Are there any desperate questions before you see how the summation machine works? That's the question. Before we use it, maybe you should see, wait, let me put a moratorium on questions. A moment, just for a moment, to see how we apply the series. Because now you're jumping ahead. And so that's not a question.
Just to see if the same thing that I say is just by using these rules, if you are allowed to do that, you can shift the sum to a sum of the zeros.
No, not an infinite number of times, only a finite number of times.
No, but if you have the sum of... If you have the second term, 0 minus 1, 0 minus 0 minus 1, and you
wait,
count
back
from 0.
That I didn't follow. Where is 0 minus 1? Where is 0?
That's the one you
What are you applying it?
No, okay. But
I no longer know what series we're talking
about. You cut the first term as you did there.
Which first term in what series?
The series.
This series?
Yeah, you've written something there. And
right.
Then you've written two sums. We split it in two sums.
Yeah, yeah.
And if we cut the first term, we get 0 and 1 plus 0 plus 1. And the second sum, we've got minus 1 plus 0 minus 1 plus 0.
I didn't follow that.
No, but here the first term is 1 minus 1. You can't just pull out just the 1 without the minus 1 in this series.
Okay, so you've written, in what you've written, regarding my time, which separates
maybe, okay, there are just so many, we could do this and we could do that. Why don't we first examine where we're going, and then once you see where we're going, then you see what the rules are for handling infinite series, because otherwise it gets boring. There are too many private, personal, technical questions. So I think that's it's not. It's, at a certain point, it gets non-productive. So let's see how to use these two axioms. Okay. So somebody gives you the following series. Okay. And he says, what is the sum of that series? Can you, in a sensible way, define the sum of that series? So you say, I have a summation machine, and I don't know how it works exactly. In the sense that I do know how Borel works, I know how Euler works, okay? But I don't know, I haven't specified what the actual technical things you're supposed to do to this sum. So I write down the sum, 1 minus 1 plus 1 minus 1. And all I can do is to apply our summation machine, which I haven't even specified. And all I can do is use axioms 1 and 2. Okay? So let's assume, the first thing we have to assume is that our summation machine is powerful enough to assign a finite number to the sum of that series. And we'll call that finite number S, okay? But I don't know how it did it, okay? Now, there are several things that I can do. I can certainly use axiom number 2, if I wish, okay? So axiom number 2 says that I can pull off the first term of the series, okay? So I can write this as 1 plus the sum of minus 1 plus 1 minus 1 plus 1 and so on. And that's all axiom 2 says. Okay? And now I can use axiom 1, which is the axiom of linearity. Okay? So axiom number 1 says that I can factor out a minus sign from every term in that series. If I wish. Okay? So I can write this as minus the sum of 1 minus 1 plus 1 minus 1, and so on. And I can do all these operations under one assumption, the assumption that our summation procedure is powerful enough that we are not simply adding infinities and subtracting infinities, because that would be nonsense. If we have the difference of two infinities, that
would be a nonsense result. Okay? But this is equal to 1 minus s by our assumption. Okay? And so therefore, 2s is equal to 1. Okay? And so s is a half. And that is the reason that we got 1 half when we used Euler summation or when we used Borel summation. Why did it give 1 half? Because it had to. Okay? So when Euler proposed his summation procedure, when Borel proposed his summation procedure, their procedure involves some technical description. You know, you have to learn how to use it. You have to put in n factorial. Maybe he wanted you to put in 2n factorial or something like that. But that isn't the point. The main point is that both of those summation procedures obeyed these two axioms. Okay, and that's how you use the axiom. And in fact, the point, let me try to make this point a little bit more carefully, or let me make it again. You notice that we claimed that this series, the sum of this series, is not the same as the sum of that series. Okay, it's not the same. Why? Because it would only be the same if you were allowed, for example, to associate terms in the series infinitely, which we're not allowed to do. Okay? We're definitely not going to do that. Okay? So we're not going to combine 0 with its one of its neighboring terms. Okay? We're definitely not going to be allowed to do that. But the question is, what would our summation procedure say about this series? Okay? So let's try it. Let's see what happens. So suppose we have the series, as we said, 1 plus 0 minus 1 plus 1 plus 0 minus 1 plus 1 plus 0 minus 1, and so on. And we ask, is it possible to assign a sum to this crazy-looking series? Okay, so we trot out our summation machine. We don't know how our summation machine works. We have no idea how it works. Okay, and we're leaving that in the dark. That's a black box. All we know is that it has properties 1 and 2. Okay, and maybe you would be happier if I called, maybe we'd be less pretentious if I called this property 1 and property 2 instead of axiom. It's too mathematical. But we'll assume that there is an answer, S. Okay? Now, all we can say is that by axiom or property 2, we can pull out the first term in the series. Okay? And we can write this as 1 plus the sum of, and now all the rest of the terms in the series, which would be 0 minus 1 plus 1, 0 minus 1 plus 1, 0 minus 1 plus 1, and so on. Okay? And that's all we can say. Of course, I could use, if I wanted, I could use axiom number 2 or property number 2 again. Okay? So this is number 2 here. And I could use number 2 again and pull out the first term in the series if I wanted, right? So I could pull out a 0, first term in the series. And what I'm left with is the sum of the series minus 1, plus 1, 0, minus 1, plus 1, 0, minus 1, plus 1, 0, and so on, all the way up. Okay? Now, you know what I'm going to do next, of course. I'm going to use, you notice I have this series and this series and this series, and I'm going to use linearity. Let's use linearity. So let's use property number 1. So this is equal to S, and this is equal to S. So if I add this guy to this guy to this guy and use property number 1, I have 3S is equal to 1 plus 1 plus 0, which is 2, okay, plus the series that looks like this. Okay, by linearity, this is the series. The first term in the series is 1 plus 0 minus 1. The next term in the series is 0 minus 1 plus 1. The next term in the series, so that's this. The next term in the series is minus 1 plus 1 plus 0. Next term and so on. Okay? And every one of these terms here, this is 0, that's 0, this is 0, and so on. Okay? But this is a convergent series, and our summation machine always returns the value of a convergent series as being the correct answer. So we conclude that 3s is equal to 2, so s is equal to 2/3. And that's the reason why Mr. Euler got the answer 2/3 here, because he had to. Because really, this is nothing but linearity. Okay, now you have a question.
Just from doing the second axiom a third time and pulling out 1 plus 0 plus
1. Nothing. We can do that.
But then that would just give you zero.
It may give you a truism. Of course. You can. I mean, there's nothing that prevents you from doing it. You can do it again. Of course, you may not. You may end up with no conclusion, or you may end up with an equation which is just true. A true, you know, 1 equals 1. It's not a. It's not a contradiction.
It's just true. I agree. You can do that. Okay? But you see what we are doing here. We are assigning, in some sort of coherent, sensible way, we are saying that it may be possible. It isn't absolutely rigorously shown or anything like that, but that it may be possible in some sort of general sense or universal sense to assign a sum, a finite sum, to a series that diverges. Okay? Now let's do this again. You have questions? Yeah.
Okay. So in this case, we're going to need a third axiom that is, if the series converges, the summation machine has to give the sum of the convergent series.
If Yes, but we have that.
Yeah.
We just said that. That's axiom number 2.
Okay? That's axiom number 2, because we repeatedly apply this axiom, okay, and pull off the first few terms, and these things are changing less and less and less. We have to assume, of course, something about this remaining term. Okay? There's buried in here is the assumption that if the series is converging, that it has to give the right answer. Okay, and that's what I'm trying to do with this axiom here.
Okay, because as in 2, you have out more of the
finite. That's right.
Terms.
Yeah.
So I don't know that it's inconsistent. So why don't you try to prove that they're inconsistent?
I'm not sure.
Okay, so try to prove it.
We can always use some trick according to get some results.
No, we can't always.
For some series, we can play it and get some results.
Which may or may not. No, no, we can't always. No, that's not true.
I'm not saying it's always. I say for some series, we can.
For some series, yes.
Play with it and get some. Result.
Right, and we don't know whether or not that is always correct.
Yeah. And we do this in another way, maybe some other tricks, but still obey these properties. Is that possible to get something?
Maybe. Try to find an example. I mean, I don't know, but you can try and see if you can find something. It's not obvious that you will find something, but maybe you will. And if you can, that's very interesting, which means that we will need some other axiom that refines these, that distinguishes these two cases. Okay, that's the danger. Okay. So I don't claim that the sum is unique.
Okay.
Okay? I haven't made that claim. It's just working in a few cases. That's all.
But I think for example, for example, one or two,
yes.
one over one half. I think there must be some background.
Yes, we're going to investigate this a lot further. Okay.
So, maybe for other zeros, if we always get same number from different ways.
Okay, so okay, let's, I think it's worthwhile trying to apply this technique to some other series to see what happens, okay? Because the only way you can get to know it better is to actually solve some problems. Okay, another question. Okay.
Even a certain series, it's always possible to construct a machine that's powerful enough to send it?
I have no idea. I mean, that's an interesting question, and I have no idea. I mean, you're asking how universal is this? How is it possible, what you're saying is, possibly this machine will tell us that the sum of the series is infinite, or possibly these axioms are not enough to come up with a determination of the sum of the series, and that there may be a more powerful summation machine. And there are more powerful, I've already said so, that there are, not more powerful, there are other summation machines that do not respect these axioms, but can sum the series. And I'm going to show you one. I'm going to show you one right now.
And don't respect these axioms?
And do not respect these axioms. Sorry?
If it doesn't obey axiom number two, it can possibly, if you apply the machine to a sum that converges.
Right. So let me show. Okay. So if you give me a chance, I will try to show you. Okay, and we'll talk about it. I mean, this is not a rigorous branch of mathematics yet, not completely. So you can't ask me questions that in all cases will this be true, because I can't answer that. It's just, you know, this works for really important and interesting physical problems, and I will show you that, but I can't provide you. If you're a mathematician, I can't provide you with issues of absolute issues of uniqueness and existence. Can't do that yet. It does simply that there is no comprehensive mathematical theory of summation in existence yet. This is an ongoing developing field, and it's interesting, okay? But it's not a complete field, you know, like Taylor series. Okay? So let's do a few more examples. Let's look at the question of what is 1 plus 1 plus 1 plus 1. It seems to me that's a very simple series. Okay? What is the sum of that series? Well, let us apply our summation machine to that series. Okay? So let's assume that the sum of this series exists, okay? That our machine successfully assigns a sum to the series. Now we use axiom 2. And axiom 2 says 1 plus s of 1 plus 1 plus 1 plus 1, okay? But by our assumption, this is s, okay? And so now we learn that S is equal to 1 plus S. Okay? So we have an equation for S. What is the sum of that series, therefore? Okay? Well, we predict, I mean, our machine, just using the properties of our machine, we have no choice but to conclude that S equals infinity. That's the solution. That's the unique solution to that equation. So we conclude that that series is infinity. That doesn't bother us. It's perfectly okay for that series to be infinity. Okay? And by the way, let me just make an argument. I mean, sometimes it's wonderful that a series adds up to infinity. I don't have a problem with that. Okay? However, I can show you another machine that says this series is finite. Okay? And this machine is called zeta summation. Okay? But this clearly does not respect the two axioms or the two properties that I specified. So what is zeta summation? So we say, let's define the function zeta of z. Okay? Zeta of z is the sum from n equals 1 to infinity. What is it? Do you know what it is? You may have seen this in some of your courses. What is this?
One, say again louder. 1 over n to the z. That's right. 1 over n to the z. Okay? So, for example, zeta of 2 is the sum of 1 over n squared, which we know, we've discussed in this class, is pi squared over 6, right? And zeta of 3 is the sum of 1 over n cubed. And what's that equal to? Anybody know? It's equal to zeta of 3. Okay? I mean, there isn't any other way of writing down the answer. It is simply zeta of 3. Okay? Nobody knows how to express zeta of 3 in terms of other numbers like pi or gamma. Okay, so that's zeta of 3. Okay? And now, you know what I'm going to do, of course. I'm going to say, what happens if we take the limit as z approaches 1? Or sorry, as z approaches, not 1, but as z approaches 0. Okay? So if you let z approach 0, that gives you zeta of 0, and zeta is an analytic function. And we can analytically continue. Okay, of course, this series exists and converges so long as the real part of z is what? Say again?
Larger than 1.
That's right.
Okay? Nevertheless, we can analytically continue to other values of z. Okay, so we can take this series, write it as an integral, analytically continue that integral to other values of z, such as 0. So we can take the limit as z goes to 0 of zeta of z, and we get zeta of 0, which exists. Does anybody know what it's equal to? Zeta of 0? It's minus 1/2. Okay, so if you're doing zeta summation says that the sum of this series is minus 1/2. Okay, and people use zeta summation, physicists use zeta summation all the time when you are calculating physical quantities that involve summation over modes. So do any of you know an example where you need to sum over modes? Say it again? Exactly. Exactly. That's wonderful. It's a wonderful example. Summation over modes. So how does the Casimir effect work? So this is a beautiful example, which is now observable in the laboratory. You can actually observe this as a real effect. So suppose you have a metal plate here, an infinite metal plate, and a metal plate here. So this is a capacitor, and it's an infinite plate. Okay, it's infinitely large. Okay, so this is an infinite plane, an infinite plane here, and an infinite plane here. Okay. and there is no electrical charge on the plate. So classically, there is no force between these two plates. They're just two metal plates. However, you know that in quantum mechanics, there are modes, okay? So there are standing waves between these plates, okay? And each mode has a certain energy. There are possible modes, okay? So there are the energies E sub n associated, or maybe we should call it omega sub n, associated with those modes, okay? And we can ask, what is the zero point energy of this cavity, okay? And you can add up all the modes, and of course you know it's going to be infinite. Quantum field theory says that when you add up the possible modes of a field, of any field inside here, like to assume it's a scalar field, that the zero point energy will be infinite. If you sum that up, it will be infinity. Okay? But now you can say, suppose, however, I move one of the plates out to I move it a distance, let's say epsilon. Okay? And now I have another sum of modes. So this is one value, one sum of modes, this is infinity. Here's another sum of modes, which is also going to be infinity, where I have shifted the plates by an amount epsilon. Okay? Now this is infinity and this is infinity. And the difference in the energy is that much. And it still is infinite. Okay? If you combine these terms, you know, if you sum up the omega n in the original position, say A, at the point A, at A, and you subtract omega n at the point A plus epsilon, this sum is infinite. So that's a sum over modes, and it's infinite. But if you use zeta function summation, you get a finite answer. Okay, this series typically diverges like n. Okay, the nth term in the series diverges like n, but the sum of n is zeta of minus 1, right? Which is a finite number, which is something like minus 1/12. Okay, so it's a finite number. And when you do that sum, you find that this difference is finite. Okay, it's different. The difference is finite. And so what we have shown is that if you shift, there's a change in energy, you can calculate the energy as a function of epsilon. Okay, and then if you differentiate that with respect to epsilon, that gives you a force. The derivative of the energy with respect to the difference is a force, and that says that there's a force between those plates. That's a physical result, that if you have two uncharged plates, quantum mechanics says there's a force between those plates. Okay, it's actually an attractive force because this number is negative here. And you can go into the laboratory and measure that force, and it's there. Okay? Yeah.
You're using analyticity property of zeta function.
Of the analytic property.
Does this result tell you that that quantum field theory actually exists beyond, say, the canonical quantization methods that we use? Yeah. Where
I don't so think it does. I mean, if you ask, what is really going on here? This is not really quantum field theory. I mean, it's if you want to call it quantum field theory, it's at the very most basic level, because we never actually specified what field we're talking about. We're just talking about the modes of some field, okay? And we haven't specified the Lorentz transformation properties of this field, or we haven't gone into any depth. In principle, we could, and these are very, very, very hard calculations to do. We haven't done that. Okay. In fact, the physics is
really the physics of waves. Because, for example, I don't know if you know this, if you take a boat, you know, if you look at, if you go out to the docks, you'll see the boats being loaded or unloaded there. People who operate docks understand how boats work. And you must never put two boats next to each other like this and take and have people, you know, take a little boat out and go in between them, because you can die. And the reason is because there are waves here, and these two boats feel an attractive force, which is exactly the same, just because there are waves, there are standing waves between those boats that cause an attractive force between the boats, just the way there's a force between these plates. It is just the property of standing waves. Okay, so essentially, you sum up all the energies, you look at the density of states. This is just the property of waves. I wouldn't go as far as to say this is a validation of quantum field theory. It's really merely the statement that there are wave-like structures between these two boats, okay, that causes an attractive force. And the boats are drawn together, and they will crash. Just because there are disturbances on the water, wave-like disturbances, and these wave-like disturbances create a pressure that brings the boats together. Okay? If you ever find that you're taking a rowboat between two big boats, get out of there, right? don't stick around. Okay, so...
Sorry.
And, yeah?
Doesn't that attractive force depend, mean that there are waves on the outside of the two boats?
Yes, indeed. And you also have to include the effect of waves on the outside. However, you see, this is assumed to go all the way off to infinity, and this goes all the way off to infinity. Okay? So when the distance between the plates changes from, say, A to A plus epsilon, okay, the waves on the outside, there are also there's a density of energy on the outside, density of waves on the outside. That doesn't change, because this is still a semi-infinite domain, and this is a semi-infinite domain. So we argue, right or wrong, that this doesn't change. Because if you move this plate by a little bit, the distance from here all the way up to infinity is still infinity. So when you make this subtraction, this effect cancels out. And this just becomes irrelevant. And the only thing that's relevant is the stuff in between. Okay. Now, the question is, if you use zeta function summation, you can ask, what is the sum? What is the sum of the series? So you understand, I've made an argument that the series 1 plus 2 plus 3 plus 4 by zeta function summation is finite. It's equal to minus 1/12. Okay, it's a strange result. What about zeta of 1? Zeta of 1, you probably know. What is zeta of 1? Infinity. Okay, we know that the zeta function is singular at 1. So we know that 1 plus a half plus a third plus a fourth and so on, this is infinity, at least by zeta function summation. Okay, and I have no problem, again, with this series being infinite. And in fact, I would even argue that this is extremely useful to us, say, in, I don't know what you're going to go into. Maybe you're going to become architects when you go. Okay. If you're an architect, this is extremely useful, this fact. Okay. Okay, so let's see why. So suppose I asked you, suppose you have a bunch of bricks like this, and you decide that you're going to build a bridge just by piling bricks on top of bricks. And the question is, how big an overhang is it possible to make if you just simply lay the bricks on top of the bricks, just one at a time? Okay, no glue. You don't nail the bottom brick to the floor or anything like that. So do you suppose it's possible to make an overhang as wide as one unit, one brick? Do you think that's possible? It's not obvious, but let's see how you would build a bridge with bricks. This is, I mean, just a one-sided bridge. Okay? So you take a brick. Okay, and let's suppose this brick is 2 inches wide. Okay? So how far out can you get another brick to sit on this brick? Well, I could put a brick so that the center of mass, this is the center of mass of a brick, a uniform brick, sits right on the edge of the bottom brick. Okay? And it will not fall over if I do that. Okay? So now I have an overhang of half a brick. I asked you before, can we have an overhang of one brick? And I've certainly got an overhang of half a brick. Okay, but now we have to ask, what is the center of mass of these two bricks as a unit? And the center of mass sits right over here. Okay, that's where the center of mass of that full chunk. So I can rest this on top of another brick. So now I have an overhang of one and an overhang of one half. And then I can ask, what is the center of mass of this unit of three bricks? And the center of mass of this thing is over here somewhere. And if you work it out, it's trivial. The center of mass, you guessed it, will be one-third. Okay? So you can continue piling bricks. This will have an overhang of one-quarter. And the next one will have, you know, I'm not drawing it very well, but have an overhang of one-fifth, and so on. And if you continue piling bricks on, very carefully, you have an overhang of one plus a half plus a third plus a fourth and so on and so on. So it's infinite. So in fact, you can build a bridge. Of course, it only converges to infinity logarithmically. So you need a huge number of bricks to do this. But in fact, if you just add up the first few overhangs, you know, just one plus a half, plus a third plus a fourth, let's see, that is already bigger than two, right? So this is already one brick, right? So and this will not fall down. This bridge will not fall. Of course, you can only build it. It's a tricky thing. You have to have a very powerful helicopter, and you have to put the bricks underneath. You can't build it up from zero. You have to build it down. Okay. So in general, I don't have a problem with divergent series, and I don't have a problem with a series adding up to infinity. But let's look at something really cool, because, and you've already seen
yeah. I think I saw one plus two in string theory.
Sure. Well, you're summing over modes. It happens in string theory all the time.
Yeah. I'm not sure about that, but if you look at the string
theory. No. Renormalization is used. No. When you write down, in general, in field theory, when you renormalize, the purpose of renormalization is to make the coefficient of your coupling constant to the power n finite. But then you have still an infinite series to sum. And that series now has finite terms in the series. Well, let's talk about this later. This is not relevant to okay. So let's look at another interesting series. Let's look at the series. Let's look at it. Instead of looking at a series like this, I would like to look at a series which is more rapidly. Okay, we only have a minute or two left.
But.
Sorry?
Why do bricks fall at the summation?
Why do bricks
fall at the summation?
I'm just arguing that that series, well, I'm arguing that that sum, if I take a finite number of bricks, I mean, that's, you know the answer to this question. If I take a finite number of bricks, then I can sum it. There's no ambiguity about the sum, and it's clearly bigger than any arbitrary number. So I'll pull back a bit, and I'll only make a bridge with a finite number of bricks. And now it is unambiguously clear that that sum of bricks is arbitrarily large. And we don't have to even use the word zeta function summation.
Can you then say that because of that, there must be a finite number of particles in the universe? Because it is.
Okay, so let's discuss this afterwards. Okay. So there is a little bit more that I want to accomplish in this lecture. Okay, so I'd like to look at the following series, 1 plus 2 plus 4 plus 8 plus 16. Okay? And in fact, this is an extremely famous series. Why is that? Because there's a story associated with it, right? There's supposed to be, I don't know, I've heard it 100 different ways, but there's supposed to be a Chinese emperor who likes to play chess, right? And he's got a farmer living on his property growing rice. And he says, you have to pay me tax in order to grow rice in my on my property. So every day you have to pay tax. So on the first day you have to bring me one grain of rice, put it on the first square of my chessboard, and then tomorrow you have to bring me two grains of rice, and so on and so on. Okay, so that's the series that we're talking about. Of course, it turns out that the farmer is a very clever mathematician, and he says I agree to this. I absolutely agree. I will do this. And he says to the emperor, let's shake hands on it, because I want you, I will agree to your demand, but you have to, I don't want you to change it later on, so we agree. Okay, and he goes off and he says, that is a divergent series. So I will apply a summation procedure. Okay. And he argues that by property number, so he says the sum of the series is S. Okay? So he says by property number 2, this is equal to 1 plus the sum, this is property number 2, this is the sum of 2 plus 4 plus 8 plus 16 and so on. Okay? And by property number 1, which is property number one, which is linearity, this is equal to 1 plus 2 times the sum of 1 plus 2 plus 4 plus 8 and so on. Okay? So, but this is equal to the sum of the series, if it exists, so that's little s. So s satisfies this equation. Okay? So s is equal to minus 1. And the mathematician comes back the next day to the emperor and says, you owe me one grain of rice. If I pay my tax the way you ask, you owe me one grain of rice. Okay? And I think the conclusion from this is that a lot of your intuition, a lot of the things that you know about divergence, about arithmetic, are no longer true. Okay, and one of the things that is not true. So you know that arithmetic has an ordering property. What is the ordering property? Okay, so arithmetic. I talked about the three laws of arithmetic: commutivity, associativity, and distributivity. But there's also another thing, and that has to do with the ordering property. And what is that?
If you
I mean, it makes sense. I mean, it makes sense to say that A is greater than B, if we're talking about real numbers, okay? And we have transitivity. Okay, so we know that if A is greater than B and B is greater than C, then A is greater than C. So we have an ordering property and it is transitive and so on. These are standard properties of arithmetic. Now, when you generalize from arithmetic to complex numbers, from real numbers to complex numbers, you do not, in fact, give up the three laws, commutivity and associativity, distributivity, but you give up the ordering property. If A is a complex number, you know, A becomes Z, Z1 and Z2, it does not make sense to say that Z1 is bigger than Z2 in general. There's no ordering property. And what is actually happening here, why is it that, you know, what we're saying here is that if you add up a bunch of positive numbers, you would think that the sum would be a positive number. But there's no reason for it to be, none whatsoever. There's absolutely no reason. And that's because what I am doing is, what I've concealed from you, is that we are actually, this summation machine is actually doing something in the complex domain. Okay? And it was already clear when I talked to you about Euler summation. What did Euler say? Euler says, you know, write down f of x is the sum of a sub n of x to the n, and so on and so on, and then let x approach 1. What are we doing? We know that this series is a divergent series. Okay, why is it diverging? It's because there's a singularity. Okay? And so, if we were to look at this, what are we really doing in the complex plane? We're saying, consider the series of, you know, z, well, 1 plus z plus z squared plus z cubed plus and so on, where z in this case is 2. Okay? And we are summing this series in the complex plane, and we're saying that for small enough z, the sum of this series is 1 over 1 minus z. Okay? And then we're asking, where does this series converge? Well, we know perfectly well where it converges. There's a singularity at z equals 1 here. Okay? So this Taylor series only converges in this circle. And what we are doing is, these different summation techniques, what we're really doing is we're analytically continuing. We're saying we know how to represent this series somewhere. Okay? Somewhere, somehow. In here, for example. And then what we're doing is we're saying we're not going to be stopped by that singularity. We find that there's an unambiguous way of getting to the point z equals 2, which is what the original series was. Okay? And so we say a sensible way to define the sum of the series is to replace this function by 1 over 1 minus z, and then extend this function to the point 2. And that's why we're getting the answer minus 1. Okay, so that's really what is happening here. That's what is hidden behind here. And so what we're going, this is just mathematical fun and games, but we're going to start doing this. We're going to start using these techniques in actual physical problems. And I'm going to show you that, in fact, this makes sense. Okay. Now, I have to warn you, this is not a complete comprehensive theory. Summation theory is in its infancy. It's just begun. It's just, you know, very young. And the idea of applying summation theory to make sense out of perturbation theory only began in the late 1960s and 1970s. So it's very young. Okay? But it was only then, for the first time, that people realized that you can actually write down a perturbative sum, that is a sum of Feynman diagrams, which is divergent, and actually add it up and get a finite answer. And we're going to do that in this class. Okay? And that's the objective. Okay? So this is very young. And we don't know all about summation theory. We only know that it works in some cases. It may not work in other cases. So we're going to have to talk in this class about the meaning of divergent series and asymptotic series and summation theory and Borel summation, Pade theory, and so on. And we're going to learn how to actually do this. And we're going to sum up series of Feynman diagrams and get finite answers that are physically acceptable, not just, you know, fun and games, the sum of 1 plus 2 plus minus 1. That's cute. But we're actually going to sum up divergent representations for physical quantities and get finite answers. And that's really remarkable. That's really neat. That's the objective of this course. Okay? So, okay, more tomorrow. Okay, question. Yes?
So, you said that there are different ways to get summation. Like, we saw the Zeta summation, and then we saw our summation that we came
up with. Right, right. So, and for Zeta summation, as you see, I used analytic continuation.
Yeah.
And I said 1 plus 1 plus 1 can be thought of as Zeta of 0. And that the only way to get to Zeta of 0 is through an analytic continuation. First, write down this representation of the zeta function, and this representation is only valid to the right, is only valid in the complex plane to the right of 1. This is where that sum is valid. We then sum the series in this region and represent it as an integral, which is another way to represent the zeta function. And then we continue that integral, and there's a singularity right over here, and we can continue that that integral representation of the zeta function. It's the same function in an abstract sense, but represented differently. And if we analytically continue to 0, all of a sudden we find it's finite. So that lends some meaning to the to what the series 1 plus 1 plus 1 plus 1 is. Whether or not that's physically acceptable, we don't know.
That's right, a, there's a, my question mm-hmm. Series that went to sum and I have different methods. Like,
right.
How, is there any way I can decide without going and measuring the number first which one is the right way to sum?
And the answer is yes. In some cases, yes. And that's what we're going to be doing in the rest of the course. Okay.
So you need to know some of the properties of the number you're trying to calculate. So the bottom line, the answer, the brief answer, I mean, just the summary answer to your question is this. Suppose, for example, you're trying to calculate the sum of some Feynman diagrams. What you have to know is something about the answer you're trying to find and how it depends on the perturbation parameter. You have to know, for example, that it is an analytic function of the perturbation parameter. You have to know that it's not just an analytic function, but it has to be a particular type of analytic function. For example, it may be a Stieltjes function, which we haven't defined yet, but which we will. You also have to know that it has certain asymptotic behaviors for large values of the coupling parameter and for small values. You have to know certain things. And in fact, there are altogether about 4 things that you need to know. Okay? One of them is a very funny word called Herglotz. Okay? And you need to know that the function you're calculating is a Herglotz function of the perturbation parameter. So we've talked about perturbation parameters in complex parameter space, but we have to go much more deeply into it. And once you know those things, then you can prove rigorously that these summation methods, such as Borel summation, give you, or this summation machine will give you a unique answer, and furthermore, the physical answer to the problem. Okay? So that's the reason why I'm giving you this course. There's something to say here. Okay? It's not just fun and games. Okay? So the only purpose of today's lecture was to show you that it may be possible to think of summation machines that will give you, that will associate a finite sum to an infinite divergent series. But we haven't answered your question. Your question is, of course, the key question. Can we do it in physics for physical problems? Okay, and will our summation machine provide the right answer? And in some cases, the answer is strictly yes. And there's a unique answer. But in all cases, for example, in electrodynamics, we do not know that. We don't know that. Because electrodynamics and other more complicated quantum field theories, okay, renormalizable but not super renormalizable quantum field theories, we don't know that. So we can apply summation procedures, and they seem to work numerically, but we don't know that they're giving us the right answer. It's a very subtle question. This is big, big stuff. Some, who has? Yeah, yeah.
What about the branch cut from the singularity and the analytic?
There is if there's a branch cut, then there's an ambiguity because we could go around the branch cut in one direction or the other direction.
Yes.
So now there's an ambiguity, but here there isn't a branch cut.
Okay.
This is just a pole. So there's a unique analytic continuation. It doesn't matter whether we go around this way or around that way.
Okay.
But you're absolutely right. If this were a branch point, and there was a branch cut coming around it, coming out of it,
yes.
Okay, then we could, and we want to go over here. Let's suppose the branch cut is going this way. We might go around crossing it this way or crossing it some other way.
Yes.
Then we might not have a unique answer, and that's a problem for us. And we have to discuss that. In this situation, there's just a pole, so it's unambiguous. But in general, you're absolutely right, and we're going to be describing functions that do indeed have branch cuts, and we have to figure out what to do. So, I mean, fortunately, we have 7 more lectures, and we're going to do it.
Do
we have a what? Wait, I didn't say start again.
It is a divergence.
A continuous. What you mean by continuous is that this could be a